Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Don't forget, KSFR is simulcasting on 90.7 FM and 101.1 FM. The 101.1 FM frequency will be our new home. If you want to report any experiences about that signal, good or bad, please write to info@ksfr.org. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the upcoming bond issue because tomorrow is Election Day. Valerie Espinosa, County Clerk, will be joining us along with Denise Lamb and Chris Swedine from the Santa Fe Community College. Right now, I would like to welcome Ellen Zieselman. She is Curator of Education at the New Mexico Museum of Art, and we're here to talk about excavating Egypt, great discoveries from the Petrie Museum of Egyptian Archaeology at University College London. It's an exhibition which is at the museum for the rest of this year, in fact, through January 6th of 2008. Welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
Great to have you. This exhibit centers around the life and work of a man named William Matthew Flinders Petrie.
Sir William Matthew Flinders Petrie, yes.
Who was he?
Well, he was an interesting man who was born in the mid-1800s. He was actually ill as a child and self-taught largely. He was a collector of coins and interested in all things ancient, and hung out a lot at the British Museum, got a reader's ticket to the library at the British Museum when he was about 21. And when he was 26, he went to Egypt and spent the rest of his life. You know, he went to Egypt in 1880, and I think his last excavation was in 1942. And really just spent his life excavating in Egypt and what today is Israel and the Palestinian territories.
So when we look at archaeological museums and exhibitions that go back that far, you sort of forget that the study of archaeology itself is not nearly as ancient as the objects we're looking at. This is really a late 19th century phenomenon.
It is indeed. And one of the things that Petrie is really credited with is coming up with standards and practices that today archaeologists still follow. He's known as the father of Egyptian archaeology, and he was really one of the first to recognize the value of finding objects in their entire context and having as much context as possible for an object. Apparently, before he went there, people were just digging up big things and selling them because people were interested in them, and he really found the value in small fragments and in everyday objects and things that were just, you know, most of the big pot hunters, if you will, were leaving behind.
Well, there's an amazing moment in the essay about him in the museum catalog where he talks about how unfortunate it is when we walk in our heavy boots and crunch on the pottery under our feet. And you just cringe. I mean, no modern archaeologist would ever set foot on fragments of pottery.
Right, and yet this was sort of happening. I mean, there's this other quote he writes in a letter when he lived in a tomb, an empty tomb, when he first got there in 1880. And he does mention to his parents that there was this better tomb that, you know, was better situated, but he would have to dig out all the bones and dirt and, you know, stuff, you know, clear it out before he could move in, so it's not worth the time, so he lives in this other one.
Why did he live in a tomb?
I think it was free. I think it was pretty cheap. I think he was...
Didn't have a commute to work, I suppose.
He didn't have a commute to work. He was a very efficient guy, and he worked, you know, there are quotes about him working in his underwear, which would keep local, you know, sort of rubberneckers away. And
well, it was so hot also.
Exactly. And, you know, I think when they say underwear, they do mean like the full-length, you know, union suit.
No. That's right. And if he wore pink underwear, then it really kept people away because they thought he was strange.
Right. They didn't know what to make of him.
Which he was.
He was a bit of an odd duck, but, you know, I guess sometimes that's what it takes to be a visionary.
So he went to Egypt, and what kinds of objects was he taking out? Was he piecing together fragments of broken things? Was he looking for intact things? What kind of things did he find, and in fact, during this exhibition?
Well, you know, it seems some of everything, and there are definitely some large finds that he would have, mainly because there was a deal where, you know, the Egyptians weren't completely unaware of what was there, and so there was a head of Egyptian antiquities, and they had a ratio, I think it was two-thirds to a third, that the Egyptians got the first pick and they got to take 2/3 of what he found, and he was able to keep others. And he kept some large things to sell to collectors to fund his future excavations. And he himself seemed to collect a lot of smaller things. Sometimes they were fragments that he pieced together. Sometimes they were just fragments that he saw value in. And this exhibit is filled with really wonderfully small, intimate, everyday objects. And some things, like there's a piece of pottery or stone fragment that has looks like a sketch of Nefertiti from the Amarna site. And just things like, you know, he saw that that artists, just like artists in our own day, would make a sketch before they would paint commit something to the wall. And so these little fragments that have little faces on them seem to be that.
Are they ever correlated with big works that have remained?
I think they are, but I'm not an Egyptologist myself. I don't know that specifically.
We're talking about the exhibition Excavating Egypt, which is at the New Mexico Museum of Art. Let's talk more about this question of context. He was the father of Egyptian archaeology, and his great contribution was finding things in context, which we've talked about on this program before in the context of the archaeological sites that are being looted in Iraq and the tremendous amount of knowledge that's being lost because things are being taken out of context.
Right.
What does context tell you, and what kind of context did this man Petri find?
Well, you know, in general, and archaeologists of all stripes will tell you that, you know, you can't just look at a vessel, say, and have any real sense of what its use was, or, you know, the best you can do is surmise. I mean, I think a lot of that comes, you know, Mimbres pottery, for example, we have some ideas maybe of what they were used for, but oftentimes, you know, they're just ended up in collections because somebody found them in their backyard and didn't do a big archaeological dig or pot hunted or whatever. Context, it's the ability to know where in a room, for example, something was found, what other objects were found with that object. There's a set of objects in this exhibit. There's a necklace and a bead and a ring that were all found on in the same burial, and we knew, you know, Petri left evidence of where they were found, you know, that the necklace was found around the neck of the body, and the ring was on the finger of the body, and that, you know, there's wear on the ring, and so you have a sense that it wasn't just made for the burial, but it was really something perhaps that this woman really used in life and enjoyed. And the little vessels that are part of it, you know, even though they're broken, even the fact that they're broken gives you an idea of how they were made on the inside, because you can really see that they were carved out of this calcite, this Egyptian alabaster. So, you know, context just gives you a broader picture of the culture itself and the whole, you know, how objects were used rather than just that they were created.
Are all the objects that are in this collection objects that were found in tombs?
A large majority of them are, and apparently the Egyptian culture was very much interested in preserving the life that they had during life, and that their concept of afterlife was you just sort of kept living, only in a different state. And so the portraits on the mummy cases were a way for your soul, once it had been judged favorably, to come back to find your body, because, you know, they would have a picture. And the objects that were left behind were things that were things that the person had used in life and would want to keep using after death. And one of the greatest sources of Egyptian everyday life of a certain class, mainly an upper class, is paintings, tomb paintings, which are not in this exhibit because they're too large and on the walls of tombs. But the tomb paintings, which really show these activities that they had been participating in and would want to keep doing in the afterlife.
What kinds of people got entombed? Presumably not everybody.
Well, you know, it's a strange thing. Not everybody, for sure, although the earliest mummified bodies were the lowest classes of citizens, because what happened was they would just bury them in a hole in the sand in the desert, and that would, the heat in the desert and the sand would create all the
inadvertent mummies.
Exactly. And then a higher class started putting them burying them in boxes, and the bodies were decomposing, and so they had to create the concept of mummification to replicate what had been happening in these, you know, just pits. And there are definitely the afterlife was certainly reserved for upper classes, and in earlier periods, just the pharaoh and priest class, and then later, as I understand it, they were the upper class, the nobility, also got in on the act.
A question that always comes up for me with this question of tombs and knowing about a culture through tombs is, you know, if I go to a New Mexico cemetery and I see the tombs, the tombstones there and the things that people leave, how much could I really tell about the way we live our daily lives here in New Mexico? Is it analogous there? Do you know how much we can tell and really what is missing from the jigsaw puzzle of Egyptian life?
You know, you never know. And, you know, I think about, like, the ancient Greeks and Romans, and we have some text from them. You know, we have these plays and things like that. But what if, you know, what if we're missing a whole bunch, you know, the other side of the story, for example? You know, I often think that if you know, again,
the stuff the women wrote, for example.
Well, that would be one. Or, you know, I mean, in our own culture, what if you only had, you know, the Washington Times as your, you know, source of what
right.
our
the
culture
whole, the
was.
The whole archive survives.
The whole archives of the Washington Times survives, and it would be an accurate record on the one hand, and yet we'd be missing a whole lot of nuance about our society. And so I'm sure that that's true with ancient cultures. What's fascinating, though, is how much we can glean from what has been found, and really how humanity hasn't really changed drastically, and I think this is a good thing. Humanity hasn't, you know, they weren't these alien species 5,000 years ago. That we're still pretty much who we are.
And certainly not primitive when you look at this exhibition.
Absolutely not primitive. I mean, the things that they were carving and crafting and creating for themselves to make their lives more beautiful and more adorned and more interesting are really, I mean, they're phenomenally created objects. And to, you know, they didn't have half the technology that we think of as necessary for life, and yet not at all a primitive society, very advanced.
And the visual culture and the visual objects that remain are incredible. There's one of the things that's striking in the show, just a little thing, but there's weights that, you know, a scale with a balance on each side, but the little weights that go on the scale are carved in the shape of really incredible little animals.
Right, there's a hippo weight stone, and then there's a calf weight made out of metal, and you're right. I mean, they were using simple weights, you know, and balance scales to conduct their business. And
but like
yet,
the hippo was 10 grams and the whatever.
Right, they definitely had specific weights, and they knew exactly what they were doing, and they could have just used a lump of stone to do that, or a, you know, lump of metal, but they took the time to carve them and make them interesting, and, you know, just like we do with things that we use every day, you know, I don't know, like bunny slippers, for example.
Which probably will not survive the next five
Sadly,
millennia.
Sadly, they may not, although photographs of them may, which will really puzzle archaeologists in the future.
They might think we were a subspecies of ourselves. We're talking to Ellen Zieselman, Curator of Education at the New Mexico Museum of Art, about Excavating Egypt, the exhibition which is on view until the 6th of January of this coming year. What were Sir William Matthew Flinders Petrie's favorite objects?
Oh, well, I think he loved them all equally, but that's because I have no idea. And my favorite objects in the exhibit are, there's a pair of tweezers and a little bronze razor and that are metal. There's some little iron plates that are like half an inch big at best, little squares, and they were apparently put as like chainmail, as armor. There's a little vase that probably held perfumed oils that is on its side because one of its handles, it's shaped like a swan, and it's just beautiful. There's a piece of papyrus, a fragment from the Book of the Dead, that's just, you really get to see how similar papyrus is to paper, but really how different as well, that it's really just this bark, and yet the writing on it that's, you know, 3,000 years old is just phenomenally beautiful and elegant and everything that, you know, a beautiful text would have today. And I mean, there's just such a variety of objects, and from there's objects from every period and just about every place in ancient Egyptian history, and you just get a real intimate one-to-one. You know, these objects which you could hold in your hand, someone held in their hand 3,000 years ago.
The timeline of the exhibition in terms of the objects in it is 4800 BC to 138 AD. That's nearly five millennia.
Right.
And what's funny is, five millennia, our country is 200 years old. We think of ourselves probably, maybe, as one century old, because our collective memory doesn't even extend back very far.
Right.
And then we think of Egypt as one thing over 5,000 years.
It's not so
many things over not only a great time, but a great geographical span.
Right, and there's different periods. There's the Akhenaten period in Amarna, where he decided he was a pharaoh, and he decided that instead of this polytheistic society, it was just going to be monotheistic, and he destroyed some objects and created this whole artistic style that's different. His wife was Nefertiti, and he precedes...
Same conflicts we have throughout history.
Always. There's always a struggle between, you know, wanting to be different and wanting to shift visually and
monotheism and polytheism.
Monotheism, polytheism, exactly. Excuse me. And the other thing that's fascinating is that you can really see in some of these objects how the Romans influenced things when they came in at the very end of the ancient Egyptian period. Think about Antony and Cleopatra, that time period. And the portraits become much more representational and individualized and very Roman looking. There's an encaustic paint panel of a Roman, and then there's also this curious little limestone sculpture that really just looks like, you know, he does not look Egyptian, he looks Roman. He's just, you know, kind of have this totally different expression on his face. The earliest period is there, the Old Kingdom, the influence that they were involved with Greeks way back in the Attic period. We've got these little fragments of vases that just are Greek vases, and so we know there was some connection there in the different places. And then, you know, there's also just the mundane everyday. There's a rat trap from the site of Lahoon, where
I love that.
You just realize that these people were just living like we do today. They were dealing with the elements and nature and everything else.
Let's go back to Petrie for a moment. There's this whole question of, I mean, he was allowed to take one third of the objects that he found out of Egypt, but were there politics on what he took out and the fact that he was establishing a museum in England?
I imagine there were, but I'm not positive. And I think a lot of that shifted in the 20s when Howard Carter found Tut's tomb, and then I think there were some issues about superstardus and things like that. And Petrie actually stopped excavating in Egypt after Howard Carter and the whole Tut phenomenon. It just wasn't the same place for him. And
why did he stop?
I think, and I haven't done a whole lot of research into this, but my understanding is that he was, I think he just thought that there was a purity that was lost. And so he just wasn't really, you know, I don't think he was interested in getting drawn into this whole celebrity archaeologist thing.
And so when King Tut's tomb was found, it was like a giant blockbuster as much then as it is now?
Yeah, I think it was. And because I think it was found so completely intact, and he had been doing all this excruciating work, you know, I imagine he had been doing all this excruciating work to figure out things from like the tiniest of fragments of things that had already been looted in the past, and here's this like, you know, entirety. And apparently the things that they found whole chariots, they found whole, you know, it was just absolutely intact, and there's so much, it was just this phenomenal draw. Even today, you know, we know if you go to the Cairo Museum, I think there's two floors of things they found from King Tut's tomb. So there's a lot. And I think Petrie liked his sort of piecing together the loner archaeologist. And so he chose to go to, you know, he went over to what's today Israel and Palestine and that area and excavate there because nobody was doing anything there. And he did some really interesting and important work for about the last 20 years of his life there.
So this Petrie Museum is in London, and the objects are traveling. This is a traveling exhibition. It's going to lots of different places.
Right. This was organized by the Carlos Museum at Emory University by a curator there named Peter Lacavara, and he put it all together with the Petrie Museum. And it's an important way to get their objects out into the known world. These are the kind of objects that most museums that have large Egyptian collections have like shelves and shelves and shelves of. And so if you were to go to, say, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is a wonderful Egyptian collection, you might see some of these similar objects, but you get overwhelmed by them because there are 1,000 of them in a room. And in our collection,
and probably a lot of them are in the vaults where you don't even see
them.
Well,
yeah, exactly. Or they do stick them all out on these sort of, exposed, collection storage shelving where they're just on shelves and you can see them, but they're hundreds at a time. And this is an exhibit of about 220 objects, and it's really elegantly displayed, and, our galleries are... We're doing, a good business, but we're never going to be jam-packed like the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And so, it's a really wonderful opportunity here in Santa Fe to see things that you just normally wouldn't get to see in New Mexico.
And I find that the thing that's, maybe this is just my subjective thing, but the projecting yourself into the lives of the people who, as you said, who held these things in your hand. There's a scope for opportunity in that you don't usually find in museum exhibitions.
It's true. And there's really a way you get this up close and personal, intimate look at Egyptian daily life. And it makes it very, very, takes this ancient, mysterious, monumental culture and puts it in a very human scale.
Ellen Zeisman, thank you so much for being with us here in the cafe.
Well, thanks for having me.
Excavating Egypt is the name of the exhibition. It's actually called Excavating Egypt, Great Discoveries from the Petrie Museum of Egyptian Archaeology at University College London. And it is at the New Mexico Museum of Art on the plaza right in downtown Santa Fe through the 6th of January of 2008. The time is 8:30 here on KSFR. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the upcoming election, tomorrow's election. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Valerie Espinosa, County Clerk, Denise Lamb, Director of the Bureau of Elections and Chief Deputy Clerk for Santa Fe County, and Chris Swedine, Santa Fe Community College Chief of Staff. Welcome, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And we're here to talk about the bond issue. Tomorrow's Election Day, and there is a single issue, which is the bond, Santa Fe Community College bond issue election. Why don't you tell us about what that is, Chris Swedine?
Good morning.
Thank you
for having us on your show. Tomorrow is Election Day. The board of the college called for a special election to be held to have voters approve a general obligation bond for $25 million. The majority of that money will be used to build a health sciences building, to educate nurses, paramedics, EMTs, and other medical professionals, which we have a great need for in this community. Additionally, we are going to build a Occupational Trades and Advanced Technology Center for plumbing, air conditioning, heating, some of the general trades that we don't offer in this community right now, and additionally to offer renewable energy training and expand that program. And then the balance will be used for some other needs of the college.
Now, the big question is, will our taxes increase?
Our taxes will not increase.
How do you work that?
The reason that taxes will not increase is because the college has paid down a lot of its bonds already from previous elections, so we have a lot of capacity. Also, the community has grown a lot since our last bond election, so that we have a lot more households that we're spreading this over, and so we are able to do this without raising taxes.
So, just out of curiosity, if you're able to do it without raising taxes and the bond issue doesn't pass, what happens to the money?
Well, then taxes would go down at least a small amount to taxpayers. But what we would not have in this community is the things that we need to meet the needs of our growing community, and particularly this critical health care worker shortage that we have. St. Vincent Hospital, for instance, is hiring nurses from outside the country because we do not have enough trained professionals to meet those needs. So we really hope that voters will pass this bond election. And we've worked very extensively with the community over the last 18 months to find out what people feel like they need as far as training. We've worked with the business community and others to try and help them so we can meet their needs going forward.
Bond elections. Valerie Espinosa, do people come out for bond elections?
I'm afraid to tell you they probably won't, but I hope they do. We're here to encourage participation. I know in some of the precincts last time we only had about 8 people show up, so we've really promoted this well.
So the poll workers are sitting there all day
twiddling,
eating sandwiches, playing with the paper ballots, and nobody shows up.
Unfortunately, that's the case, and that's why we're trying to get some of these smaller elections consolidated.
And oh, interesting.
We're hoping that next year for the upcoming session that we'll get to pass that through the session to consolidate elections like school board, bond elections, and water boards, those kind of things.
Very interesting. So, of course, that's why we're here this morning at the Santa Fe Baking Company, to encourage people to exercise their sacred right to vote, which a lot of people have fought very hard for over centuries.
You know, I've received 3 mail-outs from the college, so I think that's a good thing. You're promoting it well. It should turn out. You should have good turnout. Same thing for the election we just had recently for the courthouse. So, you know, it's up to you to get the vote out and up to our office to be available.
Let's talk just a little bit more about the things that are on the bond issue. There's the health care, there's the occupational trades, there's also something called enhanced food safety and food services. That's part of culinary arts.
It is. The college has had the same cafeteria set up ever since it was built, and the number of students that we are serving has more than tripled in just the last 3 years. So we are overstretched and not able to serve the students in a way that we would like to. And additionally, the Culinary Arts Lab is constantly turning students away because we don't have the capacity to serve the number of students who are interested in taking those classes.
So there's a lot of people who want to study cooking and culinary arts.
Absolutely, and there's a lot of employment opportunities in our community.
So basically, if all of these various bond issues pass, the focus is on training what? Young high school graduates? Adults in their second careers? I mean,
yes, to both of those. Lots of the students that attend the community college, of course, are coming straight out of high school. And in fact, this last year, the college started working on a program with the public schools where every graduating senior was given a letter of acceptance at the same time as they graduated. So all students are welcome to come to our college. And
whether they applied or not, they got acceptance letters?
They got accepted because people are welcome to come. We have open admission there. And so we want to encourage people. And people who perhaps thought, oh, college is not for me, we want to say, yes, it is. Come on, come and give us a try. So we want to train those students. And additionally, a lot of the other students that attend our college, many of them already have bachelor's degrees. So we have an interesting community here that we have both young students and we have workers who are training for a second career or people who are coming to us just to have an enhanced quality of life.
The Santa Fe Community College, if I may say so, could really use some green upgrades, which is part of what this whole thing is. Are you going to be focusing on the facilities at the college itself?
Absolutely. One of the things that we'll be able to install if we get this, if this bond passes, is a biomass boiler that will heat and cool the entire campus. And that will be using, we actually have a partnership right now, we're working with the Forest Service to provide fuel once that gets in place. The Forest Service needs to have an opportunity to test some of this equipment so they can find out how much of their fuel that they're cleaning out of the forest can be used and how much it would cost to ship it and so on. So we're actually going to be a test center working with the forest to find out how to use fuel efficiently and so that they can then sell it to other customers who might be interested.
And this is probably something best left for another show, but where would the, I mean, are they cutting down trees or?
They're cleaning out all the salvage and some of the dead woods, especially up in the Las Vegas area. So it's part of the regular forest cleaning, but then they have all this material that would have to go to a landfill. So we're able to take it and use it as fuel, and it also gets us off of natural gas.
Valerie Espinosa, when people call the county clerk's office about election issues, what are the most calls that you get? What are people interested in, or what are they looking for?
At this time, with the election coming up in June, that's the question they're calling most frequently about. Candidate petitions, when will they be ready? October 1st is we're going to have those petitions ready. We get various requests, address changes, and that's what we're trying to promote as well, because you know, if you don't have the correct address in our file, it's hard for us to locate you, it's hard for you to show up at the right polling place. So right now we're in the middle of updating our voter information as well. So we get various questions. I mean, you know, elections is not, the county clerk just doesn't conduct elections. We have the recording side of the fence, too, and you know that the market in Santa Fe is booming, unlike anywhere in the state or in the country.
Now, there is, you are working on a mobile voter registration unit, is that correct?
That's right. This is something we just started doing just last week, and this is going to be our second week. What we're doing is using the healthcare van that's provided with Santa Fe County, you know, where they go out and reach out to the different communities, the local rural areas, where they do the testing for diabetes and different things. We're sending one of our employees out there, and I will be going with them this week, Thursday and Friday, say to El Rancho and Pewaukee and different areas, the fairgrounds, to register people at the same time that they're there to tap into these services that are being offered by Santa Fe County. We thought we'd reach out to the voters that way and see how it worked. And it's working very well.
What percentage of our eligible voters are in fact registered? Do you know?
That's a good question. We have about 94,000.
You know, it's hard to tell right now because you have to base that on the most recent census figures. And since the most recent census was about 8 years old, it's hard to know exactly right. What the voting age population is right now. They'll be doing the census in a couple of years and then, of course, the redistricting. And so we'll have more of an idea. We do have 91,000 registered voters in Santa Fe County.
So that must be a pretty high percentage of people because we don't have a whole lot more people than that, and some of them are children. Very interesting. You guys are implementing a statewide voter database. Tell us about that. How does that work?
We began the implementation of that for Santa Fe County about 2 years ago in May. The entire state of New Mexico is on this, and it's an online real-time voter registration database. And what that means is that if you, for example, were to move to Las Cruces and register to vote down there, when your voter registration was entered in Las Cruces, it would be automatically deleted in Santa Fe County. It allows for a lot of really kind of high-tech functions that are related to election administration. But the best thing about it is that it's real-time, and so it allows us to keep the files as current and accurate as possible.
Who has access to that database?
Only election administrators in the state.
We heard, of course, in the last presidential elections, the horror stories about caging lists. What kind of safeguards do you have so that voter caging, which of course is made possible by statewide databases, doesn't happen?
Well, you know, our database, I believe, is fairly accurate. I don't know that we had any of that kind of voter caging in New Mexico, at least that I'm not aware of it ever having taken place. As you know, or may not know, I was the state election director for the 2004 presidential election.
Right.
And so we didn't have that going on in New Mexico.
Are there any safeguards to make sure that, for example, registered letters would be sent to people, and if they came back, those people would be taken off? Because that was the thing that happened in other places. I don't know about New Mexico.
There's a federal law that prescribes how you can remove people from the voter rolls. A person can only be removed from the voter rolls after 4 years of their mail coming back undelivered and them not appearing to vote in any election. After that time, you're fairly certain that they're not there.
Let's talk about paper ballots. This is a great thing that New Mexico passed. People were very happy about it. How are the paper ballot systems with the optical scan machines working in the state of New Mexico?
Well, let me tell you first about a survey that was conducted by Caltech, UNM, and the University of Utah, in which a survey was done. They tested each poll worker within the state of New Mexico, and Santa Fe County ranked the highest in the entire state out of 33 counties in terms of voter education, poll worker training, and Denise can elaborate a little bit more on that as well. But yes, our voting machines, it's showing that the system is working. People are content with the machines, and so the new paper ballot is working.
How do you train poll workers?
We have a 2-hour training for every election. And what it is that we spend about 1 hour of the training on just the procedural things of signing voters in, issuing their ballots, provisional ballots, opening and closing the polls, basically all the things that they're likely to encounter during the day. And then the second hour of the training is training on the machine itself, how to operate the machine.
And is that done county by county? I guess it is.
Yes.
So when Santa Fe is doing better than other counties, it calls other counties into question. I mean, are they not training their poll workers well?
I think the initiative we're taking is that we want to be inclusive on all levels. I mean, we have a section in there for the voter that might be disabled or handicapped. So we include that. That's one of my concerns, and we implemented different processes. But, of course, when you have the best of the best in East Lam working for you in the entire state, I mean, we couldn't go wrong.
What are the, I mean, when we talk about the 2000 and 2004 presidential elections and the many gigantic disasters that happened in both of those places, not completely excluding New Mexico, a lot of conversation came up about whether elections should be regulated on the county level, the state level, or the national level. What are the comparative advantages and disadvantages of national regulation of elections versus county?
Well, of course, there are national regulations of elections, and there's all kinds of national regulations of elections that people aren't even aware of. One of the things that it's helpful to remember is that there's no such thing as a federal election. There are elections with federal candidates on the ballot, and each county in the United States conducts elections for the federal government. You know, having the federal government control every single state's election process down to the most minute detail, I think, would probably be a big violation of states' rights. Different states have different ways of doing things, of when candidates file and how their ballots look, depending on their equipment. I think it would be very intrusive. And I also think, in this age, I think there's a certain amount of paranoia about the federal government running things, and having the federal government control elections, I think could possibly be perceived to lead to some real abuses.
But then there are the abuses that we have, like the butterfly ballots, or you know, many of the other problems that were caused by the fact that there was local control, which led to real corruption.
I don't think the butterfly ballot was any kind of corruption. It was clearly an accident. The county clerk in that county I knew for many years when I worked at the national level and state level, and she'd actually designed that ballot with the approval of the Democratic Party, who looked at it first and said, oh yes, this is very good, it'll help the older people to vote, when in fact it had the opposite impact. So a lot of the things that happen are not corruption, they're human error. You have to remember that for true corruption to occur, there has to be a conspiracy of some kind, and most people can't keep their mouth shut long enough for any kind of a conspiracy to be hidden for very long.
Well, I mean, two examples that come to mind are in Florida in 2000 and in Ohio in 2004, the Secretary of State who was in charge of elections was also the director of the campaign for one of the candidates. I mean, that's the highest possible conflict of interest that you can imagine.
I agree. That is a terrible conflict of interest. But that, is something that the federal government isn't going to be able to control. I mean, they could pass a law, I suppose, that prohibited election administrators from, endorsing candidates, which any administrator with a brain in their head isn't going to do that anyway. I mean, you want to have everything be transparent and honest when you run elections. And if you're endorsing a candidate or working on their campaign, it hardly seems possible for that to be the case.
We're talking to Denise Lam, Valerie Espinosa, and Chris Swedeen, and the topic is Election Day tomorrow in Santa Fe and Santa Fe Community College's bond issue. The great thing about paper ballots, of course, and the reason that paper ballots were brought into New Mexico is that they can be recounted. That doesn't actually probably happen all that often.
Not so far.
Under what circumstances would there be a recount?
if the candidate requests it, because it might have been from a very narrow margin, and that would be one of the reasons.
Now, when the ballots are counted, they're not counted by hand. They're put through an optical scan machine, which is electronic. It counts the votes. How do we know that that count right there is accurate?
Well, I guess the same way you know when you get your bank statement from the bank that it's fairly accurate. I mean, obviously, you're going to look at it. You know how many people voted in the precinct because you have their signatures on the roster, and so it would be fairly obvious when the canvas of the election was taking place that something was amiss. In elections with candidates, of course, there are political consultants, and they know within, you know, a hair's breadth how many people are going to vote at a given precinct and pretty much how they're going to vote. So if anything comes out wildly skewed from what is expected, people are obviously going to look into it, and then you'll do a hand count on the ballots and see if the machine was accurate.
So once the machine, so in any precinct you have an optical scan machine that comes out with numbers, where do those numbers go, and where are they tabulated on a county and a state level? For example, state elections.
Okay. For example, in the community college election, which is what we're really here to talk about, what will happen on Tuesday night is each voting machine produces a tape with the results and how many people voted, and that gets posted on the door of the polling place. So anybody who is there can look right then and see what the count is. Four copies of the tapes are generated. They come back to the county clerk. They also go in larger elections, they'll go to the district judge, secretary of state. So there are multiple transparencies built into any election system. One of the things that you might want to realize is that elections have been conducted in the United States for hundreds of years now, and over the years, procedures have been put in place to ensure that as many people are involved in the process as possible so that there can be no corruption.
One of the things that people were very interested in during the various legislative sessions where election law was being discussed is the question of audits. Were audits, automatic audits, random audits, built into the process that we have in New Mexico?
Actually, New Mexico is one of three states historically that has had a triple audit of all their election results. This is not commonly known, but in a big election there is an audit at the county level, an audit at the state level, and then the Secretary of State's office hires a firm of independent auditors, an accounting firm that comes in and goes over the returns as well.
And so that is built into the process of every election in the state of New Mexico, for example. The election tomorrow?
No, the election tomorrow will be canvassed by the county. The county clerk's office will canvass that election.
So tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen, the voters can go out and cast a ballot for the Santa Fe Community College's bond issue election. What are some of the other elections that are coming up, Valerie Espinosa?
Next year in June is a primary, and then the general for candidates statewide and county elected officials.
And what are some of the positions that are going to be up for?
State representative will be on there. Santa Fe County clerk will be on there. County treasurer, two commissioner districts, mm-hmm. And who else?
At the state level, we'll have all the state senators, all the state representatives, all the judges, all the district attorneys. Next year's ballot is what we know in New Mexico is the big ballot. Every 6 years we have an enormous ballot, and so that's what will be happening next year.
Some people think that the presidential candidates will appear on there. That's not going to happen. We're going to have a special caucus in February, and that election's conducted by the party. So that will not be on the ballot. The presidential candidates will not be on the ballot in June.
So each party has its primary. What's the difference between a primary and a caucus?
The difference is actually, I believe that the Republicans are still going to have a primary and only the Democrats are having a caucus. A caucus is a party function, and so their members vote, unlike in an election in where it's run by the state or the county, it's run by the party.
And so the Republican primary is run by the state and the county, whereas the Democratic caucus is run by the Democratic Party.
Correct.
But we're still voting in our precincts and polling places and so on?
In June, yes. There just won't be a Democratic presidential candidate on the ballot. There will be Senate and representatives and all the other offices.
If people want to find out about their polling places, that's something that probably you get a lot of calls about as well.
That's right. And let me give you a number. It's 986-6280. And I want to bounce back to the ballot. I voted early, and it's a pretty simple ballot for this election. It's either for or against, and you have an option in English or Spanish, for or against. So it's pretty basic. There's only one item on the ballot, and that is the bond issue. So we encourage you to get out and vote and get those numbers up.
Santa Fe Community College hopes all voters will come out and vote tomorrow and support our $25 million general obligation bond for better health care and for worker training. If you'd like more information to learn specifically about the issues surrounding the bond issue, you can go to a website, www.votesfcc.com. That will tell you all the details of how we will spend the money. We also have information about organizations that have endorsed, including the League of Women Voters, who did a study and decided that they would really like to support this election. And we have a partnership with La Familia Medical Dental Center, where they will be putting in a 16-chair dental clinic if this passes. So we welcome the support of voters.
That's huge. There's so many people who need dentistry.
Absolutely.
And aren't getting it in Santa Fe, and I guess probably everywhere else.
And in addition, it will allow us to teach dental hygiene and also expand our dental assisting program, which under normal circumstances would cost a lot of money to get the equipment and so on. But in this partnership, La Familia will serve as the clinical unit for our students. So it'll be open to the public for dental care, and in addition, it will be a training facility for students.
Well, all of this is available at, well, let's see, you can go to votesfcc.com, and you can also call the county clerk's office at 986-6280, they said in unison. We want to thank you all very much for being here.
Thank you, Michelle.
Chris Swedeen is the chief of staff at the Santa Fe Community College. Denise Lamb is the director of the Bureau of Elections and chief deputy clerk for Santa Fe County. And Valerie Espinosa is county clerk. Anything else you want to let people know, Valerie, before we go?
Our office is always open to answer any questions. And again, I'm going to give you the number, 986-6280. And I look forward to visiting with you again, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having this program. Thank you for having us on. And it's a great venue for education as well.
And we look forward to talking to you before the next election.
You know it.
All right then, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the colors of jazz. Don't forget, we're simulcasting on 90.7 FM and 101.1 FM. 101.1 FM will be our new home any day now, but we are still working on the signal. So if you are far away from Santa Fe or close to Santa Fe and you get a strong signal or you lose the signal for any reason, please let us know, because we are attempting always to fix the system and make it consistent for all of our beloved listeners. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Banking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.